This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates national average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
Support for the Memory Palace comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/memory. That's odoo.com/memory.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. They were beautiful, the machines. The black cast iron, the elegant curves, the spinning wheel and rocking pedal, the piston pulse of the glinting needle. A triumph of industrial design that had transformed the processes of mending and making that were still, at the turn of the 20th century, a requirement of daily life in most American households. But what really made the Singer sewing machine so desirable, and made the Singer company a corporate juggernaut, was the way those beautiful machines disappeared. You slid a couple of slats in the wooden cabinet, closed some hinged doors, and your machine would descend below the surface of an elegant desktop, upon which you could then write a letter by lamplight, or change a baby, or lay out some tea or cake for guests. That magic trick required oak. It was the only wood that could handle the weight of the machines while still being soft enough to chisel and shape at industrial scale. But as the 20th century entered its second decade, the Singer Company had a problem. There wasn't enough oak. American growth and industrialization and urbanization and consumption were consuming its forests. And if the Singer Company was going to continue to grow, it needed its own forest. So it bought 80,000 acres along the Tensas River in northeastern Louisiana in 1913. They were so beautiful, the birds. The red shock of feathers on the heads of the males, the bright white that spilled down the sides of the long throat to pool in the center of the wide wings, hemmed in by borders that look jet black in pictures, but in real life are something other. A glinting thing, a blue-purple, a night sky, on the right night. And people wanted those feathers. They were worn and traded by Native Americans for centuries. Feathers and skulls and the long bills that would chip and strip and pummel and probe the oak trees for food have been found by archaeologists in parts of the country far from any place the woodpeckers ever flew. European settlers and colonists and their descendants wanted them too, to wear too in their own ways, in hats and brooches. And so they killed a lot of birds. And ornithologists and the curators of natural history collections and dime museums and taxidermy enthusiasts killed more. They were so beautiful, these woodpeckers, that they were sometimes called the Good Lord Bird, because that's what you would shout when you saw one in the wild. And people wanted that in their lives, to study and stuff and pose and mount and marvel at behind glass, to set upon a mantle, to see how the firelight played upon those feathers. And this isn't why, in the fall of 2021, when I write this story, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service declared the ivory-billed woodpecker extinct, finally. There had been no confirmed sightings of any of their species since 1944. The hunting and collecting didn't cause the birds to go extinct. In fact, the fever for the birds, the thing that caused them to be so dear, so widely hunted and collected in the 19th century, was driven by the fear of their extinction. Because they knew, even then, what people were doing to other creatures. They knew the birds were disappearing. We're going the way of the passenger pigeon, which had flown in their billions in the first half of the century and were all but gone by the end of it, gone entirely by 1913. The American story of progress and expansion and wealth creation was also one of destruction and loss, and they knew it. They didn't understand all of it, didn't entirely understand just how human activity was leading to the loss of so many animals and birds and fish around them. And they didn't view that loss through the same lens we do now. But it's clear that there was a real sense then that something had gone wrong, and that it should go differently. that it was something someone should do something about. That it was, if nothing else, a shame. They were so beautiful, the birds. As a boy, James Tanner loved the outdoors. He spent any free hour he got exploring the woods, climbing the rocks licked by the waterfalls that draped down the green gorges near his home, mastering orienteering, plant identification, walking silently on dry leaves. He trained himself to endure the cold by sleeping on a screened porch in the worst of winter. He taught himself to sit perfectly still in the forest, no matter which bug was biting him, no matter what part of him itched or ached. All the skills a kid growing up reading adventure stories in the 1920s thought would be regularly required by adult life. But he was lucky enough to grow up near Ithaca, New York, home to Cornell University, and a professor who was becoming a peculiar kind of celebrity. Dr. Arthur Allen was America's bird expert, not only its sole professional ornithologist, but an evangelist for the love of birds. He published books and gave lectures and interviews, and the newspapers followed his exploits. He was himself that rarest of birds, a bird expert who has exploits. And he traveled the country, tracking the rarest of species to raise awareness about the threat of extinction and to study and perhaps save species before it was too late. He did it all while building up what is still one of the world's premier ornithological institutions, where James Tanner was enrolled when Dr. Allen needed someone who knew the woods. A Louisiana lawyer went out hunting one day in 1932 and came back with an ivory-billed woodpecker. No one had seen one in a decade, not since Dr. Allen himself had followed a chain of rumors deep into the swamps of Florida and then found some pecking away at a tree. Louisiana wildlife officials were ecstatic. They asked the lawyer if he thought he could find some more. It was an incredible discovery. Everyone was sure that Dr. Allen had seen the last of the breed. The lawyer said he could. So they asked him to prove it, and he went out and shot another one. Dr. Allen, James Tanner, and two colleagues from Cornell hopped in a truck and headed south, determined to find the last of the world's ivory-billed woodpeckers, and determined to prove they'd found them, without killing them to do it.
LNS Catalog number 6784.
This is a recording they made in April 1935. There used to be ivory-billed woodpeckers. They used to make these sounds. This is a recording of a lost world. The team from Cornell dragged 1,500 pounds of audio and camera equipment through old-growth forests and swamps, held it above their heads as they stepped into pools of unknowable depth, went for days and days, until they found two woodpeckers, a female and male, and watched them in the wild. The newspapers ran the photos, film clips were cut into newsreels and projected in theaters around the country, and people marveled and maybe found a little bit of hope that these beautiful birds had found a corner of the world where they could still be. Over the course of the next several years, James Tanner returned to that corner again and again. And in the fall of 1939, he knotted a necktie and went to the offices of the National Audubon Society in Manhattan to present a report on what he had learned about the ivory-billed woodpecker. He estimated he had traveled 45,000 miles searching for and studying the birds. Covering every acre, he was sure of it, of the last remaining tract of old-growth forest in the Mississippi Delta. During his most successful year, 4 years before, he saw three mated pairs and six young birds. During his most recent expedition, he found only one pair, one young bird, and three birds without mates. He was afraid they were likely unable to find one another. He said it was possible that there were 25 ivory-billed woodpeckers left in the world, but it was likely that number was optimistic. In studying this rarest of North American birds, he had come to hypothesize that the range was much smaller than people had assumed. that each woodpecker family required an area of about 6 square miles of forest to thrive. And it couldn't be just any forest. All his time in the woods, waiting, sitting still no matter which bug was biting him, or which part of his body itched or ached, or walking silently over fallen leaves, listening and watching, had taught him that the woods wasn't just the trees. It was also the birds, and the bugs, and the creatures there, the ferns and the mushrooms and fungus furring on a fallen log. The ivory-billed woodpecker's diet was comprised nearly entirely of a specific kind of grub that lived right beneath the surface of the bark of dead oak trees. They would peck at the tree and eat the grubs that were eating it, and that would weaken the dead tree, and it would fall more quickly. And as it fell, it would bring sunlight to the forest floor, and the sun would feed the woods. And on it would go in ways that James Tanner then, that scientists still, don't entirely understand. All the cycles and connections and intersections. But he knew enough to know that there were things beyond the woods that would determine what lived there. He knew the ivory-billed woodpeckers, whether there were 12 or 25 or just some lonely few left in the woods, were still alive at all in 1939, because the Singer Sewing Machine Company needed oak trees in 1914. And they were still there, the trees, because the Singer Company never really needed them. In the 1920s, women started working and living lives outside the home and didn't have time to sew and mend and had extra money to buy their clothes from stores and from the Sears catalog. So they didn't buy sewing machines in beautiful wooden cabinets. And so the birds still had a place to live. But James Tanner knew that couldn't last. The Singer Company was already selling acres to lumber concerns, were cutting trees that weren't going to die naturally, and that weren't going to feed the grubs, and couldn't feed the woodpeckers. And Tanner told the Audubon Society that the only way to save the birds was to save the woods. And they were even able to get the Roosevelt administration to agree to buy a part of it for that very purpose. But they didn't know that Pearl Harbor was around the corner. And the administration would need that money for other things. Like boxes for bullets. And rations. And bodies. And those boxes would require wood. And so, every now and again, over the past 80 years, someone would think they saw an ivory-billed woodpecker. There would be a flurry of news reports, and an influx of birders and ornithologists into what little is left of the woods once earmarked for cabinets of sewing machines. But they were only out there chasing ghosts. And now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has announced that 23 creatures, 8 types of freshwater mussel, 2 fish, a flowering plant native to Hawaii, and 11 species of birds, including the ivory-billed woodpecker, have gone extinct. The move was characterized by the Associated Press as unusual for the service, the administrators of which are typically loath to, quote, give up hope on a plant or animal, unquote. But they wanted to make the announcement in an effort to highlight the threats of climate change, pollution, urbanization, and other factors that promise to make extinctions more frequent. They were so beautiful, the birds. This episode of The Memory Palace was written and produced by me, Nate DeMeo, in October of 2021. The show gets research assistance from Eliza McGraw. It is a proud member of Radiotopia, a network of independent, listener-supported podcasts from PRX, a not-for-profit public media company. I'm very excited to announce that my friends and colleagues Erlon Woods and Nigel Poor of the incredible Peabody and Pulitzer Prize-winning podcast Ear Hustle have a book out. I just got an email from Skylight, my local bookstore, that my copy is available for pickup, so after I record this, I'm going to wander over and dive in. And as with the show, this book is an unflinching and humane and human look into life inside San Quentin Prison, as told by current and formerly incarcerated people. They are doing incredible work, and not only will you want to read this book, buying one is a fantastic way to support their project. You can find it by searching or asking for Ear Hustle wherever you buy your books. That is it for me today. You can always follow me on Twitter at The Memory Palace. I also post new episodes and big news to Facebook at The Memory Palace. And you can drop me a line to nate@thememorypalace.us anytime. And I will talk to you again.
Radiotopia.